Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
Peter Salmon.
Peter, we were just talking about your greatest hits of Guy Ritchie.
Oh, yeah.
At least the recent hits of Guy Ritchie.
Yeah, exactly. Aladdin, 10 out of 10. Man from U.N.C.L.E., 10 out of 10. Rock and Roller, 10 out of 10. All Sherlock's, 9 out of 10. No, they were great. Though they were actually my favorite of them.
Sherlock? The Sherlock Holmeses?
No, they weren't, but...
All right.
More listeners, they might have been, so I loved them.
All right. That's a good tease for what's coming up today. End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans, and we're here every Wednesday at 2 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the new crime comedy from Guy Ritchie, The Gentlemen. That's in the back half of the show. For the first half, we're going to look at some of the movie news from the last week, including Andy Serkis. He's getting a special BAFTA award for all his mocap work. So is this the first people accepting motion capture as a legitimate acting tool? And then we have new trailers this week featuring Taylor Swift, A Snow Day, and two people seemingly driving themselves crazy in suburbia, so it's a good mix. And then finally, we will talk about the passing of Terry Jones, one of the founders of Monty Python, who brought us so much comedy, and there is a lot to talk about with his legacy there. But first, Sundance. The Sundance Festival is on right now in Park City, Utah, the annual tribute to all things independent and Indian cinema, although I think it might be more apt to say that it's now the annual festival for all things coming to streaming in the near future.
I guess, yeah. I found TIFF is even more like that, whereas this, there was still some pretty indie ones.
Well, TIFF, TIFF last year, yeah, because they had Marriage Story, and they had The Aeronauts, which is on Amazon. And what else did they have? There was a couple. I can't remember them off the top of my head because I wasn't thinking about TIFF until you said that. But it is becoming more of a streaming thing. But in preparing for to talk about like what movies look good at Sundance, you can go and find the trailers for a lot of them, and a lot of them, have like, this is a Netflix film. It's already been bought. The point of this, of course, is supposed to, like, you have this independent movie that you made by maxing out your credit cards or your rich uncle or something, and then you take it to Sundance and use all the
It's like an auction. It's an auction for your film. Yep.
But now it's everybody, a lot of, I think 27 of the films there have already been purchased, which is something of a
A lot of the ones I wrote down have already been purchased and by some major studios too.
Of course, the record is still 17.5 million for Birth of a Nation a couple of years ago.
That's the record, the amount of money.
My first observation is a lot of politics at Sundance. I mean, shouldn't be surprising with President Robert Redford. It's his festival. That's a little Watchmen reference.
The ones I wrote down don't delve into that, but I might have just not paid as much attention to the political ones, because like you said, there's quite a bit of that. But I do remember the Robert Redford one. What does it delve into politically?
Oh, I just meant, because it's Robert Redford's festival. And
okay.
Political. I know he's the president of the United States in the Watchmen universe. There's the Taylor Swift doc, which we'll talk about in a bit. There's a Hillary Clinton documentary series that's going to be on Hulu in the States. And then there's a documentary about Jamal Khashoggi, who was murdered by the Saudi government. More to the point, murdered by the prince.
Is he the individual that made the Time magazine cover?
Yes. He was like... Yeah, it was like a time.
And he was a journalist too, right?
It was like the person of the year was like journalists who were like harmed.
Yeah,
or
but
killed,
he was. But yeah, he was like the one who kind of ignited that.
Right. All right. Why don't you talk about what looks good to you?
Well, yeah, like I said, I skipped past the political ones. Shirley, I thought Shirley looked pretty good. Mm-hmm. I love Elizabeth Moss, and that was about it. There wasn't that much about it, but I love Elizabeth Moss, and. It's by the director of Haunting of Hill. I don't know if you catched that Netflix one.
No, I have not seen it. That's Mick, what's his face, who did Dr. Sleep, right?
I'm not sure, but this one's by...
Mick Finnegan?
Yeah, this one's directed by Shirley Jackson, who has a huge role in it.
Oh, okay.
I liked it. I didn't finish it. It was a little too a little too spooky for me. but it was very, very well made. And this one looks scary too, but I can handle that with Elizabeth Moss. Mm-hmm. And she's doing Invisible Man too. So
yeah,
I don't know. She's getting a lot of picks for horror, so she must be good at it. Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's a good one. One of the ones that caught my eye was The Last Shift, which stars Richard Jenkins as a man who's like retiring after 38 years at this fast food place.
Yeah.
And it's his last shift. And I guess I identify it with that, and I identify with it because it's kind of like my worst nightmare.
Yeah, having to work at that kind of place.
But I mean, it's also Richard Jenkins, and he's really good, whether he's like sort of playing it for dry laughs or he's playing it, you know, kind of spooky or kind of, you know, dramatic. So, I mean, it could very well be an interesting
one. I feel like it'll be a lot of fun.
It could be like the Clerks 3 we'll probably never get.
I've been thinking Clerks, yeah. No, we're not going to get Clerks 3. Although you can purchase the full script for Clerks 3.
Yeah.
Or like he gave it to the National Board or something. Yeah, but no, we're never
going to get it.
Mallrats 2? Maybe still. Yeah, but no, that I noticed that one too, and it looked really good.
We never got, what was his hockey one, Hit Somebody? We never did get that. He talked like for an, I was at a press conference when he was in Toronto for Red State, and he talked about it for like an hour, and then that was 10 years
that's
ago.
That's happened before, yeah. But you can say that, but Jay and Silent Bob Reboot did come out and made a good amount of money, good reviews, so you know, maybe one day.
Maybe one day.
But that one, too, that one stood out as one I think I want to make sure I see it.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, a minimal plot line with some humor and just a great actor.
All right. What else do you got?
I think we're going to talk about the one later. Palm Springs.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it looked really good. I really like Andy Samberg and Kristen Milioti. How I Met Your Mother came out a long time ago. I think it's baloney that she passed away. I think it was baloney, and I'm not a fan. So she's going to be main in this, just those two, and it looks great. I feel like it's going to be a mumblecore kind of film, or at least that kind of style, because it does delve into some, they seem a little pretentious. You know, they're all about nihilism and stuff. But it centers around that, and I don't know, I just think the acting will be great, and I think the quality of the art of the film and just the enjoyment and the acting of these characters will overpass them being a little annoying, you know, because all humans are, you know, a little annoying, especially those who, you know, make not annoying to make mumblecore, but I don't think it's pretentious, but some sort of form of kind of pretentiousness, but they do it on purpose to show in mumblecore, they do that on purpose to show what, you know, upper middle class, like white kind of spoiled people are like, right? Yeah, and I think it looks like a lot of fun. Yeah, I don't know. It's hard to explain. They have pretentiousness, but it's almost on purpose. Or maybe just for me, I just love every other element of the mumblecore, so that it kind of overpasses it. But yeah, Andy Samberg, partially improv, I trust it. I think it'll be a lot of fun.
All right. Here's an unusual one. I mean, unusual for Sundance because it's like a kids' film. It's called Timmy Failure, Mistakes Were Made, and it's going to be on Disney Plus. And it starts like a kid who's like a fifth grade, like kind of Hardy Boys, Nancy Drew kind of detective. But his partner is his imaginary friend who's a 1,500 pound polar bear. But here's the thing. It's being directed by Tom McCarthy of Spotlight fame. So I'm very curious to see what this looks like. You know, kind of like Mr. Down-to-Earth, ultra-realistic Tom McCarthy doing like a kid's film for Disney Plus.
I just don't understand how it's able to be at Sundance if it was already picked up by Disney.
I know. It's a bit weird.
But whatever.
But I mean, once upon a time, there was like Miramax films at Disney, and Miramax was owned by Disney. Or Miramax films at Sundance, and Miramax was owned by Disney. So.
Well, and just regular Disney films are, you know, when it comes to the animation, beautiful. So this one, like being accepted as Sundance by Disney, it's going to be pretty darn beautiful.
Well, yeah, it sounds interesting. I will be interested in seeing that, yeah. Anyway, what else do you got?
I put Possessor. I'm just a huge David Cronenberg fan.
Yeah.
I've watched some trailers and seen some of Brandon Cronenberg's shorts, and they're pretty phenomenal too. The plot maybe looks a little like it could be a kind of like that. What was that Justin Timberlake film? Where they got like the clocks on their hands.
Oh,
or whatever.
In Time.
Yeah, the plot of
where time is literally money.
The plot of this could be like that. it just kind of is like, you know, a rich person who's able to put control on people. Mm. But I think if it's by Cronenberg, it could be a little better than that Timberlake one. I think it could really be great. It just really depends how he shows or who plays that business guy, how and why the business guy goes about what he does, and just the visuals and everything, you know? I'm hoping not CGI. I'm hoping just the classic, you know, Cronenberg, a lot of physically made things. Yeah.
I would be down for that.
Oh, also, I know I've mentioned Watchmen, but I was just because I'm thinking about Cronenberg. Jeremy Irons is like a main character. So anybody listening, if you love Jeremy Irons, like he's main. So check out Watchmen.
Yeah. I think I'll go with, for my next choice, Glorious, which is a kind of biopic about Gloria Steinem, feminist icon Gloria Steinem. It's from Julie Taymor, and it's like well, you remember that Bob Dylan movie where like Cate Blanchett and a bunch of people were playing Bob Dylan?
Oh, yeah.
It sounds like it's going to be like that, but it's like, but in, you know, it has Julianne Moore and Alicia Vikander and others playing Gloria Steinem at different points.
Okay, well, that's cool.
So that could be interesting.
Mm-hmm. Well, that Bob Dylan one was really great.
Yeah. And Cate Blanchett was really good in it. Mm-hmm. What about, like, just in brief, like, what are some other titles?
Well, it came up in the one other thing we read, but it wasn't on the list. Downhill, the Sundance film.
Yeah.
Directed by Nat Faxon. And Jim Rash. You know, I could see maybe why it wasn't on the list. Sorry that they're both funny dudes, you know. Also won an Academy Award, but, you know, no big deal. But yeah, it's Nat Faxon, Jim Rash, love them both. You know, Father of the Year and Dean Pelton. And Julie Louis-Dreyfus and Will Ferrell. It's just them being a couple and, you know, a humorous couple that gets into some great antics.
It's also a remake of Force Majeure.
Is it?
So
okay. I didn't
that
know
could
that.
Be why it didn't make the list. But
okay.
All right. Quick on my list, Lost Girls, which is Amy Ryan looking for her daughter who's a sex worker and countering the kind of the negative stuff with that, which is actually, it's already been the release that's going to be on Netflix at the end of March. Tesla, starring Ethan Hawke as Nikola Tesla.
It's Nikola Tesla.
So that's all I need to know, I think.
Yeah.
Natalie Wood, which is a documentary, Natalie Wood, What Remains Behind, which is directed by her daughter, Natasha Gregson-Wagner. Mm-hmm. So, and if you know how Natalie Wood passed away and the controversy around that could be very interesting.
Yeah, Christopher Walken and such.
Yeah. And then
is it gonna delve into that, you think?
I think it's kind of like more reflexive, like of a daughter talking about her mom. But I mean, how could it not touch on that?
Christopher Walken and who was the second dude?
Robert Wagner.
Oh, okay.
Because her father.
Yeah.
And then the last one I'll mention is The Go-Go's, which is a documentary about The Go-Go's, which is a very influential
phenomenal
80s band that should, you know, that doesn't get quite the respect and credit it deserves.
Mm-hmm. The Burt Reynolds one, too.
Oh,
Do you remember the name of that? Reynolds and Finn Wolfhard. It looked really great.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. When you mentioned Robert Redford, that's what I was thinking of, the Burt Reynolds one.
I don't know how you got from Robert Redford to Bruce, to Burt Reynolds, but all right. But speaking of underappreciated, Andy Serkis, we talked a couple of weeks ago, not Peter and I, but I think it was Candace was on that week, about the BAFTAs nominations. Got a lot of crap for not having a diverse slate, but they are giving an award for Andy Serkis for, and I wrote down, as a leading actor in performance capture, Andy Serkis has been integral to the development of this remarkable digital technology, which allows filmmakers to bring to life amazing characters that would have otherwise been almost impossible to accurately create on screen.
And that's like a bonus, but when people wanted it to be more equal, I don't think they meant like what the categories are. I think they meant who was nommed, right? But
yes,
I think that is still a really great step forward because, yeah, technology is a huge part of films, and nowadays, mainly because of Andy Serkis, it's a huge part of the acting. Well, like, the Gollum is one of the most outstanding actors, like he is in Lord of the Rings.
And there were people who were like saying that he should have got an Oscar nomination for playing Gollum. And this was,
yeah, I think
this was 20,
fair.
20 years ago, right?
Yeah.
And since then, he's added like the Caesar character from the Planet of the Apes
movies. King Kong.
Yeah, he was King Kong too.
Which is great.
But especially Caesar, which, you know, if you think about,
there's a lot of depth to Caesar.
Yeah, and if you think about the arc of Caesar where he's like starts off, you know, as kind of like a companion to, mm-hmm. you know, James Franco in the first movie. He ends up in an animal testing lab, leads a revolution.
Yeah.
Then we go to the next film, becomes a leader.
Well, and he's like the lead in the next one, right?
Yeah, and it just seems like the arc of this character, if it was human, would have
already won something.
Secured him Oscar nomination.
And it's green screen, right? Like, he's actually doing the visuals. Like, he's moving, right? So,
I mean,
this is a phenomenal step forward. And it's BAFTA. Though it's not the Oscars, it's BAFTA. So, you know, the people in the Oscar board are going to be like, oh, okay. Well, we got to change your point of view.
Yeah, it's British and swanky. And, you know, that's why it's kind of important. It's like you could just write it off and say, like, oh, they're just giving him like a bobble, here you go, Andy. Good, good job. But I think what this does is open the door to really much saying, like, this is a legitimate part of the art form. It's not so much as, you know, John Hurt could wear like layers of makeup to play the Elephant Man and get an Oscar nomination. It's the same thing here.
Yeah,
it's just because the computer turns him into an ape doesn't mean there isn't a performance here that's worthy of recognition.
Well, and it's a technology he's helped with, right?
He
owns that company.
The Imaginarium.
Yeah, I know he didn't start it, but I think that really helped move green screen CGI movement right forward.
Yeah, he's been a consultant on, you know, other movies that use mocap. So he was on he was in Avengers: Age of Ultron, but he was also there to advise
James
Spader on how to play Ultron in mocap.
Yeah.
So he's been. He's not just like the guy, like the mocap guy. He's been like telling other people how to play mocap.
Yeah.
And you can also argue, you know, other characters, you know, Toby Kebbell has been a big mocap guy as well. Judy Greer, who is also in the Planet of the Apes movies, you know, he definitely, you know.
Does that quite a bit.
Yeah, you know, learned from the master there. So,
well, it's a video game, but Rockstar's GTA 5 solely uses that element for the characters you're playing as. So,
I mean, that's
not even in the film world,
right? Well, but that's another reason why it's kind of
maybe snubbed a bit by the
snooty hoi polloi. Are you know?
That's
it's used in video games.
That's fair.
And so you know that could be taken the other way too. But I mean, we're also talking about things like the Zemeckis, the films he did that were technically animated films, but like the Beowulf, the Christmas Carol movie
Beowulf.
He did.
Beowulf was cool.
Polar Express, which, you know.
But I don't think that was the exact same, was it? Like, I don't.
No, they used I think they used mocap for those.
Yeah, mocap. Yeah.
It wasn't like.
The way they did it, I don't think they would have been able to make it look like truly realistic.
Oh, and Tintin. The Tintin movie.
Yeah, but again, that's.
No, it's not.
It's animated, yeah.
It's animated, but it was somebody on a set directing an actor.
So it's a similar motion capture. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, and that could be. I mean, that could also be another reason, because it's like, oh, you're not making a movie. You're making a cartoon. And
that can be used in a negative way. Although the acting in a couple of those were pretty good.
Well,
I was young when I saw Beowulf, but I think it was all right.
Well, it's like, you know, fully rendered 3D CG Angelina Jolie with a tail.
Yeah.
It was pretty darn convincing.
Yeah, it was a fun ride.
It was a fun ride. We're going to talk about some maybe potential other fun rides coming up in a second. We're going to take a quick musical break, though. You're listening to CFRU 93.3 FM. So that was a little past perfect. It's Speaking of Past Perfect, we were talking about Arrested Development during the break, and that was Past Perfect.
Yeah.
So, looking to the future now, we're going to talk about some of the upcoming trailers that have been released the past week. And since we were talking about Sundance, let's revisit Sundance, because one of the new trailers that was released was for Miss Americana, which is about Taylor Swift, and it'll be coming out on Netflix this week, actually this Friday.
Yeah.
So it looks like it's sort of your typical behind the music kind of thing.
Yeah, it's like her creation of it, and I think the following tours and such.
Yeah, but it goes deeper into being the politics of Taylor Swift.
And yeah, because she hasn't always been like that.
No, and she's the trailer, she says, you know, I was told, you know, to be good, you know, don't get too controversial to say thank you.
Especially when she was doing more country music, right?
Well, yeah.
Music with country elements.
Look what happened to the Dixie Chicks.
Yeah, exactly. No, that, and she's always said she's a huge fan of them, right? Well, they featured on her last album. So
yeah, that's right.
That was a justifiable fear of hers.
Yeah. So,
but the Trump thing, yeah.
Well, it's interesting. It's interesting in her case because in not being political, like so much politics was like sort of plied on her because there were like people out there who were identifying her as, you know, the quote unquote Aryan princess, like the ideals, Aryan type, you know, blonde haired, blue eyed. There were also a lot of people who kind of hate her for representing, you know, perfect, you know, artificial perfection in terms of, you know, the skinniness and the, you know, the cheekbones and all that.
I guess made a lot of other girls, or like maybe parents of the girls, view that as like what they need to be.
Yeah.
So, you know, someone, you know, tries a cigarette once and now they're not Taylor Swift, they're an evil daughter or whatever,
yeah,
you know?
That's right.
So I could see why people were a bit bugged by that. But also Taylor Swift would just be a good person. Like, you can't get mad at her for that, right? But
no.
But she also herself is aware of how many people follow along with her and how she's an icon. So
right. And, you know, when you're, people forget too, you know, Britney Spears, when she was younger and maybe, you know, experimenting, you know, mm-hmm. with being youthful and being young and having a cigarette and, you know, dating somebody and having all that scrutinized.
And she would get attacked for it.
And she was pilloried until she like literally went crazy. Yeah. And then she got attacked for that.
Mm-hmm. And there's the one South Park episode that shows that like it was forceful. It's pretty much on purpose. Like it got to the point with Britney Spears that paparazzi and people and we fans, you know, like should have known it was going too far.
Yeah.
You know?
So I mean, I understand her guardedness, Taylor mm-hmm. Swift, I mean. Having said that, this should be interesting. I mean, she's what, 30?
Oh, she'll be 31 this year.
Yeah,
her album's 1989, right? The one her she was born.
That's how. That's how I know. But she's still kind of even, you know, for someone of my age, which, you know, mm-hmm. Taylor Swift musically is a couple of generations behind me.
Oh, she's still, she's a millennial, right?
Right. But it's, you know, there's something very unknowable about her. Like, she hasn't been, like, very open about herself.
Well, for that, too, and, a lot of attacks, right?
Sure.
I remember Jake Gyllenhaal. She was the one who got a lot of smack for that, right?
Yeah.
And Harry Styles won too, because I think he was a recent breakup, and people blamed her on that as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So I mean, this poor woman can't win, and but I mean, I think I'm kind of interested in seeing it.
My girlfriend loves Miss Americana, so I'll be watching it.
All right, cool.
Yeah. I wanted to say it looked. It also just looked like a good documentary, at least based on other concert ones, like Apple Plus's. I forget its name, but the. LeBron James and 2 Chainz documentary.
Oh, yeah.
It wasn't that great.
Oh.
It wasn't that great. This one looks like it could
be. Oh, I was just about to subscribe to Apple Plus.
This one looks like it could be of a high quality, you know?
Okay.
Like,
good.
Not shine a light or anything, but.
Well, it's from.
Good. Something good.
Yeah. It's no Martin Scorsese, which is a high bar to clear. But yeah, it's from the producers who made 20 Feet from Stardom, which was an Academy Award winning doc.
I think, especially for Taylor Swift fans, it'll be, something enjoyable.
All right, so we also have The Lodge, which is looks like a scary film. It stars Riley. How do you pronounce her name? Koo?
I don't know.
Yeah, she granddaughter of Elvis Presley.
Oh, okay.
You didn't know that?
No, I did not know that.
But yeah, she plays a woman who is dating a man with two young kids. So it's she's like looks like she will become their stepmom, but she's left alone with them in a cabin when a snowstorm comes and scary things go down. And not this. It's not the kids who are bad in this one.
No, it's the parents.
It's implied that that Grace, which is the Riley Coof player character, might be not all there.
What is it?
It's implied she's well, not implied. It's mentioned that she was in a cult. She survived a cult.
Yeah, right.
Maybe she didn't all the way survive.
And they looked at like a computer, and there was like a pedophile or something, or the cannibal.
Yeah, the kids are like
something.
It's like very Koreshy, very Heaven's Gate kind of. Cult. I mean, it's not just like, Scientology, which is a cult, but also like a big business.
Ooh,
yeah, I went there.
Whoa. I don't fully agree, but I know what you're saying. Yes.
But, there's a pretty heavy business side to it as well. Yeah. It just seems like this was like a cult of like true believers and Riley Coof.
It looked all right.
It could be.
I put down Jaden Mackle looks great in it.
Yeah, from It.
From It, right, okay.
Yep.
I put that note down. I totally forgot who that is, but yeah, no, he was great. He's the one who had lisp, right? He was probably, I think, one of the best of the young actors.
Yeah, the It kids are doing pretty good.
Yeah, I thought he was great. Yeah, Finn Wolfhard's, he's okay, but I don't know, that lisp guy kind of stood out to me when we watched it too.
Lisp guy.
Oh, I forgot his name. Well, no, I do feel a bit bad. No, I've had speech issues, but yeah, no.
All right,
there's more to him than that.
Let's wrap this trailers up with Vivarium, which is Jesse Eisenberg and Imogen Poots as a young couple looking to buy a house, and they're in this like suburban lot, and they check it out, decide it's not for them,
mm-hmm.
and they can never leave.
Yeah, it looked like a biopic of the White Album song, Revolution Number 9.
Oh, yeah?
Their room is number 9. In the trailer, they said number 9 like 50 times. You know? Yeah. Number 9? Number 9?
It could be interesting.
I actually thought it looked pretty cool.
Yeah, it's... I do hope it doesn't like get lost in the... there have been a lot of these movies.
Surreal horror, which I like.
Yeah, there've been a lot of these where it's like suburbia as hell, kind of movies that seem to come and
go.
Yeah,
but I can't think of any that are like about this. Like, what would some suburb ones?
Like Suburbicon?
Yeah.
The Clooney movie?
Yeah, or Suburbia, right, or whatever? Or The Burbs?
The Burbs.
Isn't that what it's called? The Tom Hanks one?
That is the Tom Hanks one,
scary.
The Burbs. It's right, deep cut.
I didn't see that George Clooney one. Did it delve into like a neighborhood of a more kind of empty environment?
Yeah, it's like an alternate kind of 50s, 60s kind of environment with like murder and stuff.
And isn't the Coen Brothers one with Matt Damon kind of similar?
Which one?
A Quiet Man or something like that? Or
Matt Damon? Oh, The Serious Man.
Yeah, The Serious Man.
I think that's... Isn't that Michael Stuhlberg?
Is it? Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I've never seen it. I've just seen the DVD case, and it looks like a suburban place it's set. So.
No, it's not really about that. It's about, like, this one guy and his, like, sort of, like, the exasperation of his life of living in suburbia and how, like... He feels trapped. It's actually a really funky movie.
Yeah, I do want to check it out.
That it's I like it a lot. I don't know if it's one of the best Coens, but it's probably one of the best.
It's my one friend's favorite.
Yeah.
I don't know. I didn't see that George Clooney one, and I can't think of any others that deal with the suburb in that kind of empty, scary way.
It could work.
Jesse Eisenberg looks like he'll do a good job too. I like him.
Jesse Eisenberg
can be a hit and a miss, but. Well, I quite like him.
In these kinds of movies where it's like the indie ones, he has a different mode than when he's like doing the Zombieland or the DC movies where he's Lex Luthor.
Yeah,
so.
He's like a quiet kind of like a pinch erratic kind of guy in this one, right?
And Imogen Poots and Imogen Poots is really
See, I haven't seen her in much, but she looks
but
great.
She's coming off Black Christmas, which was not a great movie, but it was a very interesting movie.
Yeah, and if you're in a bad horror film, I don't think it really has that much of a negative effect. I don't know. Now, people who like horror films pay attention, but it's not as overly analyzed as the other film genres, I find.
All right, well, we have to mark some sad news before we go to the review, which is that Terry Jones passed away last week. He's one of the founders of Monty Python. It's actually been a rough couple of weeks for Monty Python because Neil Innes died
a couple
of weeks ago. The seventh member of Python who did co-wrote a lot of the music, including a lot of the songs.
He was like the main, one of the main writers.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, you're a comedy guy, so...
Yeah, I really love Monty Python. Yeah, it's rough. He was like, he was a senior, but he was under 80. Under 80, for me, that's nowadays, that's really too young.
It's still kind of on the young side, you know?
I hope they do a big fan funeral. It'd be really nice to see, like, the last one. And John Cleese always does a really nice role for that. And I really think Terry Jones deserves a, homage of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
I got my respect for that guy because he's the director too, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Everyone's always thinking about Terry Gilliam, but he was just the first, And the Holy Grail is great, but I was in Scouts, and, like, they love it in Scouts, so I had to watch it, like, so many times. They're like, it's probably just for personal reasons, I prefer The Meaning of Life and Life of Brian. In particular, The Meaning of Life. It's a lot of skits and wild stuff going on.
Yeah.
And I like that.
A
more modern humor that I could relate to more,
Right. The Holy Grail is the sort of acceptable mainstream public face of Monty Python.
Yep.
Whereas, Meaning of Life, and especially Life of Brian, which is just, like, openly blasphemous.
Exactly, yeah.
It's really sort of tests the limits of the comedy.
Well, do you know when it came out?
Life of Brian?
Yeah, Life of Brian.
I can look it up. But, yeah, and those were, like, Terry Jones co-directed Holy Grail with Terry Gilliam. And, of course, Terry Gilliam had a big, long filmmaking career, and he's still active today.
I'm kind of okay that he wasn't the director of the last two, though, because he can focus a bit too much on, like, art and the visuals. And I don't mean visuals are obviously important in slapstick, but I mean the visuals, post-editing and, like, the colors and such. Whereas, Terry Jones knew how to make something funny.
Yeah.
But also something that flowed well enough and was funny enough and, high-quality funny that it was a great film. But not...
Yeah, well, you can see that from, like, the movies that Terry Gilliam made after
Time
that.
Bandit.
When he made, like, Brazil. Yeah, Time Bandits, Brazil, 12 Monkeys.
I can see why a lot of people like those films. Mm-hmm. But I'm very okay that Monty Python didn't go in that direction.
So, The Meaning of Life came out in 83, and Life of Brian came out in 79.
79?
Yeah.
Okay. Andrew Lloyd Webber might have done it first.
Jesus Christ Superstar,
but either way, it was still it was a film. It was outstanding and
Jesus
humorous.
Jesus Christ Superstar, was the first 77? Performance of was 71 actually. That was the first the stage performance.
Yeah.
So I don't know when the movie
but
came
still,
out.
But still, no, I was just thinking of ones that you know.
The movie came out in 73, so they turned that around pretty quick.
Either way, Life of Brian is like by far funnier.
You think?
It's funnier, yeah. It's way funnier.
I'm just listening to an interview that Terry Jones did with Fresh Air. And it's funny how he said, the Monty Python was very much about the ensemble. Because Terry Gross asked him, like what were like some of your favorite characters? Like, well, all of us played like 60 different characters.
Yeah.
And so it's hard to pick. So it was the point of it was always about the ensemble, which is...
Yeah, they need
it's
each
really,
other.
It's really interesting because, when you think of, like, Saturday Night Live and you have to, like, pull someone out of the hat like John Belushi, you think of, like, Blues Brothers, or you think of, like, Dan Aykroyd, you think of, like, Coneheads, just to pull stuff out of thin air. Or you think of, like, Dana Carvey, who did, Ross Perot and George H.W. Bush and The Church Lady and a ton of different characters. And it's a very different sort of... mold of comedy, because the comedy was the point, not the players. It was very much about the sketches and the skits.
Well, that's why it's too bad they couldn't go longer, but the third one was the last one, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, The Meaning of Life, last one.
Although they did reunite somewhat for...
For tours, yeah, but they didn't do any other films or anything.
Well, they all did voices in the most recent Terry Jones movie, which was like 2015. It was one about... they all did the voice... I can't remember the name of the movie, even though I read it this morning.
And Terry Jones' final film was the Simon Pegg one, which I think is a cool kind of British, you know, finale.
Well, it's a good connection because I'm not sure I would call Simon Pegg's comedy Python-esque, but I mean, I don't think if you were raised in the 70s or any time after
you
in
have
Britain,
to watch
you would,
it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You'd have to be ensconced in.
And I'd say in the 80s, like Mr. Bean, like you had to watch Mr. Bean.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean,
and that's okay.
Well, there's a funny bit. I have a Rowan Atkinson album where he does like a bit where he's like where he plays like a demon that's welcoming people to hell, and he's sorting everyone into groups, and he says, anyone who's ever seen Monty Python's Life of Brian over here, it turns out he doesn't have a sense of humor after all.
For Terry Jones, I just also wanted to say thank you to him for I don't know if many people probably have mentioned this in his memoriam, but I loved Dinotopia, Little Dinotopia, and I watched it on VHS at my friend's house, the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles.
Oh, yeah.
Fully created, not created, fully directed solely by him.
I don't know if he directed all of it.
But
he directed a couple of them.
Okay, but he was an actor in all of it either way. He was,
He was involved in that. Yeah. But like there were a lot of actually pretty famous people involved in that. Like Frank Darabont wrote some... Deepa Mehta actually directed a couple of them, so it was weird. All right, so we'll have to just say so long and farewell to Mr. Jones.
Rest in peace, man.
And have to get into The Gentleman, which talk about something completely different. You're listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio.
Like you to consider an offer.
Look, let me stop you right there so you don't waste any more of your precious breath, young man. This is not a discussion for the two of us. Unlike the salt and pepper, it's not on the table.
This is a big number.
And even if I was, you're several zeros short. Now, you may be able to buy your man sausage for that, but to me, it just looks rude at breakfast.
And that was a clip from The Gentleman, and it is the new film from Guy Ritchie. It stars Matthew McConaughey, Charlie Hunnam, Henry Golding, Michelle Dockery, Jeremy Strong, Eddie Marsden, Colin Farrell, and Hugh Grant, a motley crew of gentlemen gangsters, and Michelle Dockery.
I like Michelle Dockery.
She's not exactly she's not exactly an innocent lamb in all this.
No.
I do like her. I never watched Downton Abbey, but I do like her like non-Downton Abbey. Like I don't. She did this other show. It was on Bravo where she was like. It was like a Bonnie and Clyde thing where she was a con woman dating a hitman and they were kind of on the run. I can't remember what it was called because I'm trying to think in spare moments.
It was enjoyable.
But it was enjoyable. And she was enjoyable. And she was enjoyable in this too. She was a lot of fun.
Yeah. I don't watch Downton Abbey either, but a lot of my relatives do. And they mention her and they really think she's great.
Yeah. So you're a Guy Ritchie booster.
Yeah. I like Guy Ritchie. This film I think was all right. It was decent. I don't know. I thought... What are your thoughts? Exactly. It was okay.
I read somebody wrote this online. Guy Ritchie will never be more Guy Ritchie than this.
Oh yeah, that's for sure. That's for sure. And there was a lot of fun elements to it. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
And
yeah.
I really did love it. The visuals were as fun as always with Guy Ritchie. I found the pacing a bit off in the sense that there was a few like I zoned out. You know, and it's a Guy Ritchie film, right?
It took, you're right. It took so long to get going. And I think it's because of the way it's structured with the
Colin Farrell thing was kind of weirdly like disattached.
Oh, although, I think that's when the movie gets going.
Me too. But I mean, also like he had kind of gang members and then there was some other like minor gang members.
Yeah.
And like sometimes you just see them too doing their own thing. And it's, I don't know. It was... Yeah, and the Mr. Big thing, like, again, was fun, but I don't know, it just didn't flow well with, you know, what Hugh Grant was narrating about and stuff. It just, it took away from the fun kind of action scenes.
I do think, I know what you're saying about Colin Farrell, but I think that's the point where, the movie kind of finally finds where it's going, because it does start out with, like, Charlie Hunnam and Hugh Grant having this conversation that flashes back to the beginning of the story and how we, you know, get to them having the conversation. But when Colin Farrell is introduced and he's at the lunch counter, I don't know what the British what this, but it's basically a lunch counter and he's ordering something and these like teen fools come in and start, you know, griping and hollering and so he challenges them and, you know, he's challenging them to come up with like jokes and he's like, and the most they can do is like "F you" and all this and pull knives on him. And his like exasperation and disappointment. Yep. Like this is all you've got was hilarious. Mm-hmm. I loved that.
And scene. And him hanging out with his bros is really fun too. Him, my favorite scenes with him is in the boxing ring where he's like talking nicely and all of a sudden just freaks out.
Yeah,
that was fun. And his description of what they did to Mr. Big, like when he's describing it to the main character.
Yeah,
that was a lot. Charlie Hunnam, that was a lot of fun.
Yeah, that's
I guess it wasn't him for the pacing. It was just, I guess it was just all of them, I guess, had to be a part of the plot, but were separated for way too long, I think. Mm. And the Deadeye thing too, or Snake Eye, whatever his name was.
Dry Eye. Henry Golding's character.
I don't know. Again, just kind of, there's too many gains. There's too many gangs, too many things going on, and like I got they connected, but the distance showing the connections just kind of made you like sometimes like I zone out, look back, and like is this a new thing going on? Like what's going on here? You know, like what did I miss?
Yeah, I don't know. I think because the way it's set up too, it's meant it's like this very sort of Rashomon kind of thing with. Who's watching who and who's seeing what.
But wasn't... I don't think that was done in a well enough
way. I think if it had been more straight ahead, it could have been more interesting because I feel like once we kind of get away from this device of the Hugh Grant character, Fletcher, who's like the sleazy private eye and he was narrating everything.
He was great.
Oh, he was great. He was tremendous. Good, I love Hugh Grant. Like he's so good at sleazy, and it's
with those glasses on too. It's great.
The glasses make the character. Yeah. But like right up to the end, where we go super meta, and he's pitching a movie based on
that. Everything. Yeah, that too was like enjoyable, but I don't know if it worked with the flow and the kind of what was being delved into in the previous parts of the film. Because it was also in the States too.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It would have been interesting if like that was who he was telling the story to.
The whole story, exactly. Yeah, that's kind of what I was hoping.
But at the end, it's him pitching this at a movie studio.
No. And I also found the ending a little not solid enough.
Well,
it's just kind of the door closed then, right?
Leaving it open for a sequel.
Yeah. Oh, fair. Yeah. And I think there's potential for that. I think it's doing pretty good.
Well, I mean, has there ever been a sequel to like Guy Ritchie,
Sherlock?
I mean, aside from that, his there's never been a Rock and Roller 2. There's never been a Lock, Stock 2 or but I do like.
It'd be cool to see if there's a sequel. Jason Statham in it, one of his regulars. You know, it'd be fun.
Yeah, he hasn't worked with Jason Statham.
No, he's been busy with Meg, right? And stuff. Aren't they making a sequel to it too? It made a lot of money.
Making a sequel to Meg? I don't know. I haven't.
It made a decent amount, I think. He's just doing those kind of like A-list What's that guy? He used to do a lot of action films, like Steven Seagal.
Steven Seagal?
Yeah, Steven Seagal. He's like a higher class Steven Seagal, right? He's doing those kind of straight to DVD films, or ones that aren't straight to DVD, but like, yeah, they come out in theaters, but you're mainly going to watch them on DVD and like on demand. He's making money with it, but yeah.
Yeah.
No time for some Guy Ritchie, I guess, Mr. Statham.
Well, I mean, that's maybe why Ritchie's sticking with Charlie Hunnam, who was in the King Arthur movie, which I actually like, by the way.
I never watched it, but my parents liked it. Yeah. Guy Ritchie, yeah. I never see this. I'm saying the negatives, but I still didn't hate it.
Oh, I didn't know. I didn't hate it at all. It was entertaining.
I don't regret seeing it.
It was entertaining as hell. As soon as, like, when the movie got
Guy
going.
Guy Ritchie fans should see it, and I think just action fans should see it. I don't think it's one that everybody should go and see.
No, it's a Guy Ritchie film. It's not for everyone. Yeah.
But even in comparison to some Guy Ritchies, I found, like I said, a little lag in it sometimes.
There's some like openly racist stuff, which is like in character, but it's like kind of uncomfortable. Like the way they're talking about the Chinese gang with Henry Golding. Like there's some.
Oh, I guess. Yeah.
There's some turns of phrases there that made me wince a little, but. In the context of that film, I mean, it's all part of the character and the ethos and the world and all that, but that's fine. But yeah, it's very much in the mold of, and I wonder how much of this is like inspired by what Guy Ritchie was wanting to do, like after finishing Aladdin.
Something more just him.
Yeah because
the
so
power
much
of Disney and a bigger company.
Well, yeah, it just there's nothing to Aladdin that makes you think it's a Guy Ritchie movie.
No, not at all. I didn't mind it, but yeah, it was, no Guy Ritchie elements. Whereas this, there was Cockney everywhere, right? He himself is,
but even something like King Arthur, which, I mean, it could be a contributor of why he sort of retreated back into sort of something more low budget. Well, not just Aladdin. He went to do Aladdin because, you know, it was going to be guaranteed $1 billion that would put him back on the A-list. But going back to this, The Gentleman and something a little more low-key, low-budget, more akin to what he's familiar with and with the British crime kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Although the crime was marijuana. I feel like I was a little lame. I don't know. I guess maybe it's because we live in Canada where it's straight up fully legal now. But
well, it was interesting
to me. It was also
supposed
to show that Matthew McConaughey's not like the Yakuza guy and stuff, right? Yeah. Like you can't handle certain evil things. So I guess the weed makes more sense. But I also think the money he said he got through it was, I don't know if it was that realistic.
Well, there's kind of like, there's an interesting sort of like class structure to this, like, because McConaughey's character has like a speech about how like weed never killed anyone.
Which is understandable,
but you know, there's kind of like a very hoity. There's also a scene where like Charlie Hunnam kind of like yells at a bunch of people on who are doing like heroin. And,
Like,
there's this very kind of like classist, like we smoke heroin, you guys like shoot up heroin.
I've read some other articles that have mentioned that there was maybe some too many kind of drugs or like, you know, people doing drugs are evil or you know, something like that.
But, well, it's not just like
heroin's bad.
Heroin is bad, of course.
Don't
but
do heroin. Could you imagine someone tuning in right after the don't part? Do heroin. No, don't.
What a message on the 40th anniversary week of CFRU.
Is that going to be on Wednesday?
It's on Tuesday.
Oh, okay. but the day after. I hope you all enjoyed it.
But there's, I mean, yeah, it's not that don't do drugs. It's like smoke weed. Don't do that heroin junk.
Yeah.
No, that's, I mean, fair enough.
That
but,
scene, does it, with the butt?
No, you but go on.
That heroin scene was way too long, too, and kind of boring.
And there was this, like, kind of, like, serious edge where in the middle of this, like, very Guy Ritchie scene where they've poisoned the guy's, like, heroin stash that he's, like, vomiting
that
violently.
That was cool.
But at the same time, it's intercut with this other scene of, like, this very serious, like, after-school special kind of scene where the Lord's daughter is poisoned by the heroin, too, and dies.
Yeah.
And it's just, like, what are you doing, Guy Ritchie? This is like perfectly enjoyable little gangster romp, and you've got like the dare portion, like, hey kids, don't do drugs.
It's the realism of what's going on in the hoods.
I'm not sure how real it was, but fair enough.
Yeah. There was a couple standouts for the enjoyment of a Guy Ritchie film when Charlie Hunnam's character, there's like a, like 20 like gang members like, you know, threatening him because they took a video of the one killing.
Yeah.
And he's just like, all right, guys, like, I'll give you this money, you know, just give me that phone back. And they're like, nope. And he's like, okay. And then he pulls out not just a gun, a huge machine gun, and just starts firing it. That was very Guy Ritchie, and that was very enjoyable.
And not just that, but he waits for the train to pass over so that you can't hear the sound. Yeah, I mean, that was a fun scene. Mm-hmm. Also, it speaks to how hard it is to get away with crime now.
Yeah. But oh, with all the filming, yeah.
And it sets up an interesting thing later on. Where there's somebody else like dies by falling off a bridge, as Charlie Hunnam and a couple of his guys are chasing them, and then it goes back to Matthew McConaughey. So it's like, you know, you should go out with some parachutes before you start chasing people around, because it's, you know, it's twice in the period of a couple of days that they're chasing somebody who falls to their death. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's a very Guy Ritchie movie, and if that's your jam, that's your vibe, it's well worth going for it. It's not going to break the mold, and it makes me think too, there's been a very sort of interesting, I guess sort of thing lately where we have directors kind of going back to what they know. And I was thinking particularly about Scorsese.
Oh yeah, I finally started The Irishman, and yeah, it's such a classic, Scorsese.
Yeah,
but I don't know if that's necessarily a bad thing.
Oh, it's not a bad thing, but it's interesting that these directors are kind of revisiting old turf, especially when you're looking at Scorsese, who's done a lot of gangster films and have very similar themes that often come down to the fact that, you know, the gangster life isn't what you think it is. Mm-hmm. That, you know, the fun and excitement is often punctuated by like surprising instances of violence that will just often leave you sort of adrift and poor. And I was trying to think of, like, is there some sort of unifying theory to like Ritchie's gangster movies too? Because, you know, there's, you know, it's very much about like this world is filled with like a couple of people who know what they're doing, but everyone else is kind of like dopey and hepped up on the thrill and the excitement of being a gangster that, you know, maybe underestimates the dangers they face on a daily basis.
I kind of view his films as what he like dreamed of, or like what he like wanted, or it's his way of showing the imagination of people living in, you know, Cockney, you know, like lower class, like urban areas where there's, you know, drugs, guns, just a bunch of bad things, right? So, of course, the people are dreaming about being, like a heroic gangster, you know, someone who's just great at shooting the guns, and, you know, true, you know, action kind of guy, you know, and that's justifiably a desire of someone, especially in a rough area, right, where it's something that you see. And Guy Ritchie has also used Cockney. He has a specific term for his film technique, his film kind of genre. So, what I like about that is they're artists, right? And all artists make different paintings, but there's always a similar element. Mm-hmm. So I think it's what this is. It's just Guy Ritchie and Martin Scorsese being like, okay, like, this is our art. This is our film. This is what film is. Screw you, streaming services, etc. Although, obviously, it's on streaming services. But, like, screw you to mainly Disney and stuff like that, right?
Kind of,
we want to keep film art.
It is very much like him washing his hands of Disney. It's like, that's
what I was kind of picturing the whole time, him putting on a bunch of Purell sanitizer, you know? Although, like I said, I didn't mind Aladdin. I think it was better in some ways than this was. I felt like the flow of Aladdin was better. It was a better rhythm than this.
Well,
other than that, yeah.
It's easy when you're doing a shot-for-shot remake. But I'll leave that there.
Shot-for-shot. But yeah, it was close.
All right, we'll wrap up the show there. We hope you liked it. And if you want to listen to the show again, you can, of course, find us on our website at endcreditsradioshow.com. You can download us on the Guelph Politicast channel every Friday on Podbean, or you can get the show through your favorite podcast app at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. Find us on social media, on Facebook at End Credits Radio Show, or on Twitter at End Credits Radio. And Peter, where can people find you?
Mr. Tyrak, YouTube and Twitter, and we got some new videos, so check it out.
Speaking of accidents waiting to happen.
Yep, bike accidents. Accidents and goofs, y'all.
Accidents and goofs. Meanwhile, I'll be back on CFRU tomorrow, Thursday at 5 p.m. for News and Politics, speaking of accidents and goofs, on Open Source's Guelph with Scotty Hertz. In the meantime, I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or you can go to my political site, guelphpolitico.ca. And stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. And we will be back next Wednesday at 2 p.m. for more End Credits, and we'll see you then.